Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
You boldly go where no man has gone before.
Engage.
Engage. Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
I love that. It's like Uhura is saying, "Hailing frequency open, sir," to me. Like, I'm sir. I'm not sir to her. Are you kidding me? She's ma'am to me. Whoa. Welcome back. Welcome back to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. And we are still in the early days here of the podcast. It's season one. We're still figuring things out as we go. I still don't know where all my buttons are. I think this button here doesn't do any damage. This doesn't hurt anything, right? Oh, my God. Oh, boy. All right. I ruined something there. This is a great time to be a Star Trek fan, as you know. It's very exciting. We hopefully you listened to our episode with Weird Al, which was a lot of fun. We have another guest on this show as well. We're going to have an exclusive chat with Adam Nimoy. But, and here's where it gets a little science fiction, it's almost like this is the menagerie, and what I'm referring to is the cage, because the interview we're going to hear was actually from the past. It's from a few weeks ago. Adam Nimoy was in town, and we were still getting this podcast set up, and I said, you know, if he's going to be here, I'm going to want to chat with him. So he didn't come in here to Deck 44. He came in, I went to him with the mobile emitter. I borrowed it from the emergency medical hologram. I took the mobile emitter, and I went and chatted with Adam Nimoy because he was presenting the premiere of his film, For the Love of Spock, his documentary, his Spockumentary, if you will, that was premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival in April. And now the film is still floating around. It's doing the film festival circuit. It's going to be playing at a lot of the Star Trek events this year. And eventually it'll be on Blu-ray and streaming and whatnot. And I do think that it's something that you should try to check out in a theater if you can. To see the high-def footage of the original series stuff in a theater is striking. The lighting is so gorgeous. Oh, my God. So, we're going to chat with him in a moment. And I do want to say one thing, because I want to be honest with you, right? I'm an honest man. We're always honest in on Deck 44. The interview that I did with Adam Nimoy, it gets better as it gets going. I promise you. At first, I had the mobile emitter, and there were so many buttons, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and I was concerned that I wasn't recording it right. So the first 5 minutes are a mess. But then it gets really good. He starts talking about touring with the Grateful Dead and his Leonard Nimoy wearing Paisley shirts and stuff. It gets a lot better as it gets going. You got to trust me. You got to trust me. So I want you to listen to that. And also, you know, Adam Nimoy is an interesting cat. I met him for the first time in Las Vegas last year, so 2015, when he was shooting the movie For the Love of Spock. And a lot of those scenes are in the movie. And I was with him kind of all day one day, because I wound up writing an article about him for the LA Times, which you can Google and read and print out and tape up on the refrigerator and everything. And I was certain that I would end up in the movie, and I didn't. Not exactly true. My elbow is in the movie. You can see my elbow in the film. I don't know the exact moment, but I know my own elbow, which is weird because you don't really look at your own elbow that much, but I can sense my own elbow on screen, and I saw my own elbow in the film. So that's exciting to me, anyhow. So we're going to go listen to that. We're going to transport over there back in time a few months ago, and then we're going to come back and we're going to do something a little bit fun, a little bit about Leonard Nimoy and Spock, because, you know, this is still one of the early podcasts that we're recording, and I want to get some of the basics covered, and I want to make sure that we talk about Leonard and about Spock, because Spock is, at the end of the day, you know, really, really a key part of our galaxy. So what we're going to do is we're going to open a channel.
Leonard Uhura, open a channel to all decks.
Oh, and then we're going to transport back in time.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
Okay, we have now done a slingshot around the sun, and we have gone back in time. We are now no longer in the time that you were in. We are now in mid-April in New York City in Lower Manhattan. It is maybe 15 hours since the world premiere, 15 hours since the world premiere of For the Love of Spock, and I'm sitting with the director, the only man who could have made this film, not the only person, because your sister could have made it also, theoretically, not that she's a filmmaker.
In theory.
But the only man who could have made the film, Adam Nimoy. Welcome to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Thank you, Jordan. It's great to be here.
All right. So, last night, I mean, you're working on this like a madman for a year, and then you're here, you fly from Los Angeles to New York, and you show the movie, and the lights dim, and the first thing that goes through your mind is, wait, we still have to fix this, we still have to fix that, or you're just ready to go and watch it?
Well, that always occurs to me, that there's things to fix, there's always things to fix, and when we see it on the big screen, stuff gets blown up. Big time, and the little problems kind of get magnified. And so I'm always keeping in my mind a little mental checklist of things that we're going to try to tweak once we get through the film festival circuit with the film. But I was just trying to sit back and enjoy myself last night and let the film kind of wash over me. It's great to see it on a big screen. We've never seen it on a screen really quite that big. We've been in small theaters checking it. But it's really satisfying, and I just wanted to let myself relax because there had been so much anticipation leading up to the premiere.
Sure. Well, it was a pretty packed house, and I think the reaction went really well. Personally, I don't think I'd ever seen the high definition original series stuff in a theater before. I've seen Next Generation stuff because they were doing those fan screenings for a couple of years, but it hit me on like the third clip. No, a close up of Bones doing something, and I'm like, man, to see this in the theater is such a trip, because I've watched these episodes 400,000 times. I know every inflection, I know every line, but to see the lighting, and it was, you know, high def, good projection, good sound system. That was a thing that I was not expecting to come out of this movie, was like as a little extra benefit. I mean, the lighting on some of those shots. I mean, it looks really cool to see those colors in a theater. I mean, was that something you were noticing when you were cutting it together? Just how neat some of that original footage can be in a theater context.
Yeah, the film. I mean, they shot it on 35 originally. I believe we have Dave Zappone here, by the way. He's the producer on the show. He just walked in, and he's our Star Trek walking encyclopedia. I may be referring to him occasionally for technical support. Dave, I believe they shot it on 35. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
And who was the cinematographer, Dave?
Jerry Finnerman.
Jerry Finnerman, right. Okay. Yeah. Yes, he was new on the job. He was experimenting a lot. They told him to use a lot of color on the show. Color had just come in 66. All three networks were finally broadcasting all their primetime schedule in color. That was the first year. And it was kind of a breakthrough, really, for television. And it just, he did a wonderful job because it's so rich. The film is so rich, and so it's so wonderful to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the benefits. I mean, like you say, this movie is going to make the film festival circuit for a while and, eventually come out. You know, by the time this airs, we'll probably know more about that. Definitely something that fans should
you know, not wait for the Blu-ray, not wait to stream it. Get their butts to the theater and go watch it, because you know, it's a unique trip to see it in that context. The other thing that I was really taken with is that it is, and it's funny, the movie is in a way self-referential, because it opens with, this is not going to be a movie about X, it's going to be a movie about Y. Originally, it was going to be about the character of Spock, and then you realize that you have an insight into this that no one else has, and then, of course, your father passes away. So it becomes a movie about making the movie in a way, which was really touching, because I honestly felt at the end of the movie, and I know more than the common man about you, about your family, as weird as that is. I know a lot about your father, but by the end of the movie, I really felt like I don't want to say part of the family, because that's overstating it, but I felt like I really know a lot about your struggles, his struggles, your whole family's struggles, and it was really very touching. I mean, I guess in a way surprised, because there are a lot of movies about being a fan of Star Trek that are just, you know, fun and funny. And certainly this is fun and funny, but this was really quite touching. And I would imagine that was your intention going in.
Well, the intention going in, it was different from what the end product turned out to be. In part because going in, I was working with my dad, and we wanted to make a Spock doc. Just Spock. Mm. That was going to be the focus. In fact, Dad was very concerned that it not be the Leonard Nimoy show. He really wanted to keep the fans focused on the character, and really, really in great detail kind of explore about Spock and how he came about, how he was created, how he evolved, and why he resonates with so many people for so many years. And that was our initial intention. After my dad passed away, there was such a response to the loss of not only Spock, but Leonard Nimoy, the artist, the humanitarian, that we needed to expand the film to include more of his life and legacy as well, which just seemed fitting and appropriate to pay tribute to him as well as to Spock, and yet still service, you know, keep it still Spock-centric, but try to find a balance between the two.
Yeah.
And then in that journey of exploring my dad's life and legacy, my story started to become more apparently intertwined with that. And there was a chorus of people, Dave, the exec producer on this, Dave Zappone is, you know, spearheading all that I should include my own perspective, my own story, my family perspective on that, and how it kind of impacted all of us. Because, you know, we are just an American family, you know, born of immigrant, you know, my father's the son of immigrant parents, mm-hmm. I'm only second generation. But we went through an incredible time, an incredible evolution. I mean, Spock had a profound effect on us. And it had a big effect on my relationship with my dad. So we tried to, you know, the focus then turned into intertwining these three elements, Spock, Leonard, and myself and the family, and myself and my dad.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the outpouring of affection when he passed? I mean, celebrities pass away and it makes news, but this mm-hmm. was a big deal. I mean, not just to me as a fan, I'll tell you how I knew. Because when your father passed away, I wrote an obit for the Guardian, which is one of the outlets I write for. And then the next day, I had to fly somewhere. And I remember being at the airport and thinking to myself, when I get to the airport, I'm going to pick up a copy of you know, probably the Daily News will have your father's picture on the front. I'm going to want a copy of that. And I was late. So I was racing to the gate and I couldn't make it. And as it happened, my phone rang and it was my mother. And I said, hey, listen, since I got you on the phone, I'm leaving the New York area. Would you mind going to the newsstand? Because I'm 99% sure that Spock's on the cover of the Daily News. Would you mind picking it up for me? She goes, sure. And then I get an email later and she says, got the Daily News, got the New York Post, got the New York Times, got the Wall Street Journal, got USA Today, got the New Jersey Star Ledger, and that's just here. So that was, I had a stack of six on the cover of every single paper, and that is extraordinary. And that's when I said, wow, it's not just me who's a Star Trek fanatic. It's people who, you know, watch the show once in a while. So it was, how did you react to that sort of reaction?
Well, when the President of the United States issues a press statement about the impact of Spock on his life, it's pretty profound. I mean, we knew the fans were there. And the family, my family knew that, we know that he's affected many people all over the world. But the extent and the intensity of the emotion and the outpouring and the, you know, the collective grief, frankly, was a little astounding. I mean, I had people who were contacting me from elementary school. I mean, you know, everybody knew, heard the news about it. And it was overwhelming. It was a major event that we really didn't quite anticipate the magnitude of.
Yeah. Do you think your father knew when you started this documentary that he wouldn't be around to finish it, or?
No, he had every intention of being on camera with me doing interview stuff to update everything. Mm. Every intention. And in fact, in January, when he had a bad day, and probably in December, we were talking about the fact that he was likely going to have to pass on any participation in the next Star Trek installment. Mm-hmm. Because he was fearful that he wouldn't be physically be able to do it, or that he wouldn't be around. Mm. So the following week, I was over at his house and I said, you know, we got to get a camera crew over here like right away. And he said, what are you talking about? We have till 2016. We're doing this for the 50th anniversary. We have plenty of time. I said, Dad, you just said that you didn't think you're going to be around when Star Trek Beyond was going to be shooting. He said, I was just having a bad day. I'm fine. Everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
So that was in January, and 8 weeks later, he was gone.
Wow.
So I think he pretty much really intended to see this thing through with me.
Wow. Huh. That's interesting. So, you know, the movie jumps around a little bit in time, which I like. It's not as straightforward, like, here's season one of Star Trek. Here's season two. Like, it jumps to the film, and then it moves back a little bit to talk about the animated stuff. It talks about something, you know, when he's doing theater, and then it pulls back. It's like, oh, he made these albums in the 60s too, which I liked as a way of jumping around. And frankly, that's how we're going to do this interview. We're going to jump around a little bit.
That's all right.
Because there were a couple of topics that came up, and I forget where they were on the timeline, but they stuck with me as things that was really glad that were in there. And wanted to poke you some more about. So one thing was, and I was kind of shocked that you brought up, but it was so cool, because it's something that fans kind of snicker about sometimes, was you talked about slash fiction in the film. And do you know why it's called slash fiction?
No, enlighten me, please.
It's called slash fiction because of It has its roots in Star Trek. It has its roots in the relationship, the alleged relationship, or the sort of joking relationship, or maybe it's true, I don't know, between Kirk and Spock. Mm-hmm. And when people in the early days were writing about this, pre-internet and early internet days, as like kind of a secret code, it would be called K/S.
Right. Yes.
That has extended to Frodo and Sam from Lord of the Rings and whatever you want it to be. And in fact, it used to only be about same-sex relationships. Now slash fiction is just whenever you imagine two characters that you love having a relationship, which is funny, silly. I don't think, you know, I once did an interview with William Shatner and brought it up, and he laughed, but he didn't want to discuss it. He's like, yeah, people say anything next, you know, just didn't want to get into it. Wasn't offended. Mm-hmm. When did you discover this?
I discovered it about a year ago when I was doing research and just going, you know, looking through Wikipedia link to link to link on everything Star Trek. And then there was this link, and it was this article was pages long.
Yeah.
Because it began early on in the 70s, and it said that it was kind of the progenitor of this whole genre, really. It was the original, and it just kind of fascinated me. And the more I read about it, and there was a Time magazine article that also commented on it, and then I saw the YouTube video, some of which we have in the movie.
Right, yeah.
And I just thought it was very it interested me in respect of that these guys are a model relationship. Mm-hmm. That they're close together. They've gone through so much together. They watch each other's backs. They have had internal conflict. They've had external conflict between the two of them. They've resolved their conflict. You know, they just continue on as a couple. And the fact that they both happen to be men is sort of irrelevant to me. It's just that they have a really strong bonded relationship, and I think it's a model for people.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, to some, it's a goof. Like, there's there's one famous episode where Spock's rubbing his back or something, and then there's another episode where somebody makes a comment that seems a little lewd, and they glance at each other, and it's funny. But for others, in their time off, they've written these fantasies, and some of them are a little bit more risque than others, but harmless fun, I would imagine. And it's a testament to the characters that people can project whatever they want, onto that, I suppose, So that was kind of a neat moment in the film. The other thing was learning about how in your father's early years after the service, when he was a struggling actor, one of his odd jobs was installing fish tanks. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you had a great fish tank growing up? I mean, did he get access to? You did.
We had fish tanks all the time since I was a baby. Every house we moved into, there was a fish tank.
Was that like a thing that he loved to do? Like, they say it's very calming. It's something to watch, fish.
It's fantastic. I mean, they're high maintenance. I mean, you have to really, keep an eye on those things. But they're fun to have. It's fun to collect fish and see how they interact. It's great to just, it's great to just sit back and burn one down and...
Watch the fish.
Well, it's funny you should put it in those terms, because something else that you mentioned in the film was when you were in college, you were you traveled with the Grateful Dead.
Well, I didn't travel with them. I followed them.
Yes, you. Yeah. If they were playing in Berkeley, you went, and then if they were playing in Sacramento the next night, you got in the VW microbus and went to Sacramento. And what? So during which time period was this? 70?
This is the 70s, really. Starting in 73 and right through that decade, which is really the defining decade for that band. That's when they really came to their fore. Yeah.
Did you see them in 77?
I saw them in 77.
That was the best year. In May of 77, this would be East Coast concerts, though. Did you make it to the Florida show?
No. It was all California.
That's the home turf. But
Yeah. I mean, I was in school. I needed to pay attention to my stuff. Literally, I had friends in Portland who told me that they had a ticket for me. They had to the show. They had a hotel room for me, and they had a tab of acid for me. All I needed was a plane ticket to get up there.
Oh man!
And I didn't go. I was in school. I'm sure. It's like there has to be some limits, and I had goals and objectives in my life.
All right. You see, but still, you were at the shows, the local shows, and the 77 gigs in what is it? The most famous one is in where's Cornell University upstate. I can't remember, man. Upstate New York, Cornell University, that town, Ithaca, New York, thank you, is where in 77, and then down in Florida, that whole stretch. May 77 happened to be when Star Wars was coming out. Everything was happening at once, May 77. But what I wouldn't give to see some of those shows. Of course, if you were there, you can't fully remember them, but
No, of course not. We were impaired.
You still go see music live, or?
I'm always going to music live, yeah. And now it's so interesting because Justin Kreutzmann, who's the son of Bill Kreutzmann, the drummer for the Dead, is a big fan of Spock, and he and I have bonded because we're both kids of celebs.
Sure,
And he's always inviting me to events. Dead. The remnants of the Dead. I was at the Fare Thee Well concerts last summer as his guest, and. It's just, I love the band. It's, and Mickey Hart was a huge fan of my dad. And the other interesting thing that didn't make the movie, but there was a little, an interesting story about my dad once asked me if I knew who Owsley Stanley was. And, my dad and I had a lot of conflict about my love of the Dead.
Sure.
And I wasn't sure where the conversation was going. I was getting very nervous about why he was asking me about Owsley Stanley. Owsley Stanley, of course, recorded the Dead early on and mixed up a lot of their LSD.
Right.
To
those who don't know and are about to hit Wikipedia, Owsley was an absolute innovator in sound technology. He created what was called the Wall of Sound, which was the very specific amplification system the Grateful Dead used. That was, and also the way they recorded their stuff. The reason we have some of these tapes from the 60s and 70s was because of him. He had a special soundboard. That was his day job. His night job was he basically invented the modern strain of hallucinogenic drugs, and he was eventually arrested for this, right? I think so. I don't know. Or he had to go on the lam. So why was he asking you?
My dad was asking me because I think there was actually an obit in the Times that my dad had read about Owsley. I think he got in a car accident several years ago. And I said, yeah, well, why are you asking? He said, because he was in my acting class.
No joke.
His acting class. My dad taught acting from roughly 60 to right up till Star Trek, around 65, 66. And Owsley was in his class. And in fact, he said that Owsley came up to him one day and said, I'm going to be leaving class because I'm going to be working with this rock band in San Francisco.
Wow. See, that's funny because, you know, your father is a 60s icon, and the ideals of Spock, the sort of the philosophy of Spock is, to me anyhow, in touch with the counterculture, but I don't consider him a countercultural dude. You know, part of this is in the movie, how your mom said, look, we got to dress you a little cooler. You know, he put on the ascot or the scarf and some of the paisley shirts. But, you know, his music, you know, the albums he put out, you refer to them as like Charles Aznavour style, which is a very very nice way of putting it. So the way a son looks at a father, you know, it's very, very loving. Yes, we'll put it in the Charles Aznavour group, but not particularly hip, you know, not the Dead, not the Vanilla Fudge or whatever else was going on at that time. Was he a countercultural dude? I mean, or was he straight?
No, he was not. Interestingly enough, he really was just not that aware of what was going on with the counterculture as much as. And again, he didn't really have the time because he was so invested in Star Trek. It was so time demanding, and he was so focused on his career. My mother, however, was really a kind of even though it wasn't really her generation, she was a flower child. I mean, we had flowers all over our house. They were mostly dead flowers, like dried flowers and flowered stickers on everything. Mm. She was a flower child, and she dressed that way. And in fact, my mother is the one, she was listening to Cream when my dad was listening to Charles Aznavour. And my mother insisted and took us to the Cream farewell concert at the Forum in 68, which was one, I mean, we were like right in front of them.
No joke.
We had incredible house seats in front of the band, and it blew my mind. That was all my mother.
Really? Wow. That's fascinating. Fascinating, as they'd say. You know, it's funny because the image of your dad with in the movie, there's one shot of him with this like amazing paisley shirt, and that's when it hit me. It's like, you know. You know, there are these touchstones of the 60s that aren't anti the counterculture, but aren't aligned with it either. You know, it's like the James Bond stuff. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's a little hedonistic, but it's not like in any way radical left or anything like that. So what, politically, was he on the left, or I would...
Politically,
would he be rooting for Bernie Sanders right now? Or
well, that's a tough call. I think he's got a lot of allegiance to Hillary just because of past history, having supported the Clintons. But I, my parents were very politically active. They were very anti-war. Mm. They took us to a lot of demonstrations. We went to candlelight vigils at UCLA campus. They were heavy supporters of Eugene McCarthy in the peace movement in 68. Mm-hmm. And They were very left wing active, you know, politically. They're definitely heavy in that respect. My dad actually campaigned, I think, 35 states for George McGovern in 72 on a peace platform as well.
Yeah.
So that kind of gives you the sense of where he was coming from.
Yeah. Not too surprising to hear that. Something that was not in the film, but I remember from the last time we spoke, when we were talking about this, was I think after Star Trek was canceled and before he was kicking off into theater work again, he bought a pet store, or he was the figurehead of a pet store, or what, did he actually own it? Or
yeah,
it was, can you remind me that the pet store story? And there's a picture floating around of him with just like an orangutan, or am I imagining that?
No, part? You're not. You're okay. Not hallucinating,
okay.
Jordan. It was Leonard Nimoy's pet pad. I believe it was during the Mission Impossible years.
Okay.
There was a really good friend of my mother's living out in Canoga Park, and she was an animal fanatic, and she approached him about the idea. And I think it was on Topanga Canyon Boulevard, I believe, in Canoga. where they got the storefront, and we and my sister and I were involved in building this, putting this thing together. We were painting cinder blocks, and we had a whole aquarium wall, you know, to satisfy my dad. And there were a lot of exotic pets and a lot of pet supply stuff. And Leonard Nimoy's Pet Pad was born. And it was a kind of a, it was a great, wonderful, exciting moment for us, and it was just a lot of pure fun.
Yeah.
But the friend who ran the store didn't have the business acumen to really keep it going, and it drove my dad crazy because he's a complete businessman. He's a numbers guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
My dad didn't have much formal education, but he could crunch numbers like it was unbelievable what he could do. He really understood business. His business manager used to say he was one of the only one client of his in Hollywood who really understood what he was doing in terms of investing. So it drove him insane. And finally, he basically sold the store to her and let her continue to run it for a while. And then it finally closed.
But for X amount of time, and you could, you know, did you have access to cool animals whenever you wanted to hang around with a...
Yeah, when we were out there in Canoga Park, my mother would take us out there and we would hang around the store and we would help them out a little bit and clean it up and... And yeah, sit with the spider monkey, you know, and the raccoons, and there was an elephant there the opening day, and there was a lot of exotic stuff there that we really had no business being there.
Awesome, you know, that's you know, you mentioned your father's sort of business sense, and I think this came across in the film how he grew up poor, you know, his parents were immigrants, and he never wanted to have a situation where he couldn't provide for the family. But that took its toll because working on a show back then was incredible hours. And then on the weekends, he was doing public appearances. Mm-hmm. And there would be whole stretches of time when you never saw him. And yet all your school friends loved him dearly because he was Mr. Spock. Mm-hmm. And there were stretches of time when it was like, hey, you know, you're seeing this guy as much as I am right now. You know, it's... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were you hesitant to put that aspect of your story in the film, or I mean, because that's
no, I think that's, you know, I think it's an honest and a common, I think, casualty of being in a celebrity family. It's just one of the challenges that we have to deal with, I think it's just a common situation to be in. It really applies to anybody who has a parent who is very successful in whatever endeavor they're involved in. It's just time demanding. These things are across the board, and that's why it's so interesting that people come up to me and say, oh, my dad was a stockbroker and I never saw him. And he had, you know, he was a legend on Wall Street and everybody knew him and everybody, you know, hung out with him and that kind of thing, but that they had very little relationship with him because he was so invested in his work. It's a very common situation.
Mm. My father worked from home. I saw him more than enough. No, I'm joking. If he's listening, I saw him the perfect amount of time. So let's talk a little bit about the film here. You had interactions in the film from everybody one would want and one would expect. Mr. William Shatner shows up, Walter Koenig, Nichelle. And then there's like one or two people you're like, hey, who Jason Alexander, what's this guy doing? I mean, not that we don't want to see him. And he does a pretty good impression of Captain Kirk, giving the risk is our business speech. How did he show? Was he like your neighbor? You like this guy?
No, Jason and I, he was an acquaintance, really. I mean, he helped me out with some fundraising at my kids' public school when they were in elementary school. And I knew he was a fan, and I asked him for a Seinfeld script signed, and he was happy to provide one for me. And in the phone conversation I had with him, he told me about his love of Trek and Spock, and I knew he was friends with Bill Shatner, and he's been on, you know, Howard Stern, and he's one of the most high profile Trek fans around. And I just thought it made sense to, because we're trying to. The film is trying to give some sense of why the Trek and Spock has resonated and just keeps rolling on, particularly in popular culture. Mm-hmm. So that's why we had this focus on the Big Bang Theory, and I wanted Jason to come in because he's like a younger generation who is, you know, has been a big part of popular culture, and he is just perpetuating the whole thing. He's one of these guys. So I thought it might be interesting to get him in a chair and see what he had to say.
Yeah, no, it was great to see him, and also. You talk about the fans. I mean, you did a whole segment at the convention, the Vegas convention last year, which is where you and I first met, and talked to fans there. And that was, you know, your first time, not your first time at a convention, but your first time mixing it up with the fans, I would imagine. We walked, you and I, the merch room. We looked at, you know, dinnerware with paintings of your father on it. And, you know, you said a very political thing. There was something that looked kind of, it was a pretty dumb piece of memorabilia. And I said, what do you think of this? And he said, whenever my father was confronted with something like that, he would say, ah, yes, an excellent likeness. It was a yo-yo, start, you know, Spock yo-yos. Was that your first time being inundated in a merch room like that, to see just the wall of merchandise with Star Trek stuff on it? Well, P.S., which we love, by the way. I mean, for this, I mean, mind you, I have a whole room dedicated to this crap, you know, but.
Yeah. Well, it was the first Vegas convention I had been to, the first of the major, you know, it's kind of the mecca of conventions. I was at the Chicago convention in 2011 where my dad did his farewell appearance to the fans. I was at that one, but I'd never really gone to other conventions. That was really the first time I had really kind of spent a lot of time, several days, kind of experiencing what it's all about and meeting with the fans and going through the merch room. And getting on stage and talking with Adam Allen, who hosts the convention, so that was, it was kind of a new experience for me.
Yeah, and it's fun. You can see why people would, you go once and you think, all right, I went once. We're like, no, I had a really good time last summer. I want to go again. You know, it's you know, and there's multiple ones. Maybe you don't go to Vegas. You go to the one in Secaucus or something. But you know, there's good times to be had. Your interaction with Star Trek is not only through your father, it's yourself as well. You, of course, did direct two episodes of The Next Generation. These were not Bobo episodes. These were season six episodes. These were dynamite episodes, you know, I think.
Were they?
Timescapes and Rascals with the little kids.
Yeah.
Do you want to reflect at all on that? Can I? It was a long time ago, right?
Yeah. Well, they were my first jobs in the industry, and it made sense. I mean, I had been apprenticing with Nick Meyer on Star Trek VI, what it meant to be directing, and I was on.
What did you, when you say you were with you apprenticing? You were just.
I was sitting. His gopher, basically. Nick would say, you know, there's a cigar tin in my trailer, and in that tin are some cigars. Get me one.
But in between that, pearls of wisdom just floating constantly, you know, just taking notes.
No, it was a great experience watching Nick, and you know, my dad helped me secure that position with him, and Nick is an incredible writer, and he did a great job on that film, and I learned a lot hanging around just to see how movies are made. And then I spent an entire season on The Next Generation, watching their directors.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, entire season.
Yeah.
Just watching how it's done. And finally, Rick Berman gave me my shot, and I directed a couple episodes for them. Very difficult, very challenging. I mean, Kids and Animals, by the way.
Right, your first one, and I believe it's your first TV credit, period, was the episode Rascals, and they say don't work with kids, and the first thing you do is work with kids.
Right, very challenging.
Way to go.
Yeah, I know, very, very challenging. But I had a lot of help, a lot of support from the crew, and I loved Next Generation. I mean, I really got to know those people very well. Very, very difficult, challenging work, particularly in season six, because they've done it. You know, they've been in it. It's getting a little old sometimes. It's a real challenge for a newcomer to come in and try to create something.
Well, in the episode Timescapes, it's one of Picard's great line readings. Really, I mean, if you were to do the list. And I'm surprised I haven't written it yet on One Trek Mind on StarTrek.com. Picard's funniest moments, he's talking about the professor that he spoke to, and he's talking in one long, unbroken sentence. I mean, Patrick Stewart is... But you say, by season six, he was sort of... He did it, you know, he didn't...
Well, any group of people who are on a show that long have, you know, it's... You really have to find ways to keep them energized and creative and challenged. You know, it's really important to do that. And when I was more seasoned as a director, I had those tools to do that. Mm. But very difficult for a first-time director to come into that situation because I can't tell them anything. Really can't talk about character. They know their character.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can really bring to that. All I can do is try to bring some visual sense and some very tight storytelling technique.
On a very rapid timetable because those shows
8-day shoot yeah. and you're gone.
But, you know, it's funny. What you just mentioned is something that J.J. Abrams says in your film, which is when J.J. was directing your father. He said to you, "What the hell am I gonna? I'm gonna tell Leonard Nimoy how to be Spock? Well, mm-hmm. you gotta be kidding mm-hmm. me! I mean, he could do 100 other things, but which I thought was pretty funny. So listen, we're just about running out of time, and we're here at 35. But there's a few little things I wanted to mention. Number one, weird trivia: your stepmother, who makes an appearance in the film and is discussed in a lovely manner. She's Michael Bay's cousin or something like this, or
once removed. Yes.
Have you met the dude ever?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe that there was, you know, the big Seder or something where everybody got together, but no. Okay. It seems like a nice guy. I don't know. But that is a weird, for those who like to do, bar trivia, there is a connection between, Leonard Nimoy and Michael Bay from two ways. Mm-hmm. There's the relationship, but also, of course, your father voiced Galvatron in Transformers the movie.
Correct.
Michael Bay directs the Transformers movies, and there you go. We just got a free drink at the bar. The music, I thought you were joking. Last night, you're like, "I want to thank my composer. He's here tonight." His name was Pike, by the way, which I thought was funny. Captain Pike. Nicholas Pike. And you said he composed the score on his home recording kit, the demo, whatever. It sounded great. And he said to you, "Adam, there's one place we got to go, and that's the Macedonian Radio Symphony or the Symphony Orchestra of Macedonian Radio or whatever it was." But that's true. That's actually who recorded it, right? Or were you kidding?
That was true. No.
What is the name of the group that recorded it?
It's the Macedonian Radio Philharmonic.
There you go. And they're in Macedonia?
They're in Macedonia.
And you... They did not come to L.A. You did not go to...
No, this is a way... The point was that Nicholas had created about half of his score was orchestral in nature, which is in Star Trek tradition, really. He's just following tradition. And we were listening to it on his sound system in his studio at home. And he said, "You know, you can get away with this. It's going to be fine. But if you really want to blow people out of their seats, we should hire an orchestra." And there are these Eastern European orchestras who are very talented people and who are very inexpensive to hire. And you can see what you're getting because of the Skype connection. I mean, before Skype, they weren't able to do this, but now it's very commonplace to hire these orchestras. And the Prague Philharmonic is the same way. Mm. They're very inexpensive ways to get a 60-piece orchestra to play your orchestral score for your film.
So now we have a connection between Star Trek and Macedonia that we didn't have earlier. And we have your film to thank for it.
Well, I got to tell you, the composer, Oleg, I think his name was, at the end of it, turned around to the Skype camera and gave us the Spock salute.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's great. Cool. Well, listen, you know, let's leave it on that note. You know, now, it's like I said, it's mid-April right now. The movie just premiered last night. Tomorrow, you're doing a chat with Zach Quinto, who we didn't even talk about, but he's in the film as well. And it's funny because you save him to the end. You talk to everybody else from the new movie, Chris Pine, Simon Pegg's always very funny, but Simon Pegg brings the house down with a couple of lines. And I'm thinking, is Quinto not in the movie? How is Quinto not in the movie? And then the third act, you know, and it's very touching what he has to say. And he and your father really did become friendly. It was not just a contractual friendship. They were chums, you know? I mean... And you, I would imagine, got close to him as well, or?
Well, I mean, not really that much. I mean, I think Zach is based in New York, and they spent most time together here in the city. But I got to know Zach a little bit over time, and they just had a really beautiful relationship, frankly. I mean, I think Zach also looked at my dad as a father figure. And my dad was a very different person at that stage in his life, frankly, once he and I kind of recoalesced and our relationship got better and his career started to wane and he was really in the third act of his life. My dad was very focused on family. So he was a great guy to be around. He was much more relaxed, very confident with himself. And Zach Lost his dad at a very early age, and I think the two just kind of really, it just, they had a really great relationship. And I, it was something that for, there was a second of twinge of jealousy in the connection that they had made, but then it was very quickly became apparent to me that they had a really, it was a very loving and a beautiful connection of passing the torch to another generation. I mean, yeah. Zach is beautifully carrying on this tradition of Spock.
Yeah, no, 100%, yeah. So yes, there's going to be a chat between the two of you tomorrow at some point, and then the film will show a few more times during the Tribeca slate. And as of right now, are there other festivals where it's has yet to be announced, or it's?
At the moment, we are going to be probably exhibiting the film and other Trek-related events coming up.
Okay,
but that remains to be seen, and we will. As we move along, yeah. I will certainly keep you informed as to where we're going to be.
Cool. So other Trek-related events, possibly other festivals, and then eventually theaters, and then certainly home video, streaming. You could buy it and buy one for you, buy one for your family. There's a lot of opportunities. But in all sincerity, no Star Trek fan, no one listening, no one who bothered to listen to minute 40 of this podcast will watch this movie and not be moved. I mean, that's just all there is to it. This is something that fans must see, and this is something for people who are, you know, Star Trek light, you know, I think would still be quite touched by as well. It's a very moving portrait of a father and son and a celebrity that we all know, and a lot of great clips, you know, cool stuff to watch. It's a great thing. So a round of applause for the love of Spock. But listen, one thing that we got to go, because as you know, this is still early days for the podcast, and early days with special guests. You're one of our first. We're still looking for benedictions from people in the Star Trek world to bless this podcast as it journeys forth into the galaxy. If there's any sort of special saying that a Vulcan would say to the podcast as if it were a sentient being, what would that Vulcan say?
He would say, "Vulcans never bluff." No, that saying would be, "Jordan, live long and prosper."
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
We're traveling forward in time. We're re-emerging from the past. Whoa. Well, that was nice. That was nice. Adam Nimoy blessed the show. He gave us a Vulcan benediction. And, we're now back in time. It's now no longer April. I don't have to wear a coat. I can go out wearing short pants because it's warm weather here in New York. And in the interview that I'm sure you were listening to very attentively, but not too attentively if you were driving. I don't want to be responsible for anything like that. If you're driving, don't listen to me that much. You know, listen to me in the background if you're driving. If you listened, I referenced the day Leonard Nimoy passed away last year. And writing an obituary, no, I don't even want to call it an obituary, writing my thoughts about Leonard for The Guardian. And I am going, rather than you have to go and Google it and read it, I'm going to read it to you, which is something you should never do on a podcast, is read something written because it's boring. But I'm going to do it anyway because it's for Leonard. And I think it's emotional, and I think that you'll like it. And emotions are actually what Spock was all about in a weird way. Whoa, this blew your mind. But we'll talk about that more some more later. So here we go. I wrote this about, you know, 20 minutes after I learned that he died, I wrote this. And it is called, "To a Star Trek fan like me, Leonard Nimoy meant everything. 27th of February, 2015. If you were a kid who liked Star Trek in the mid-1980s, it was something you kept to yourself. I don't know how a major franchise, a huge source of revenue for large entertainment conglomerates, could also be a secret shame, but it was. If you liked that, quote, gay show with cheap sets,
As one of my tormentors put it, you weren't sitting at this lunch table. No way. And when you have to go back to school each day and face the kids who laugh at you, as all kids laugh at all kids, but some more than others, you need to find a coping strategy. Mr. Spock, the greatest thing about the best fictional universe ever created, had the solution right there in his very first scene. After hearing the term irritated, he gives a puzzled look. Then, spoken at a distance, a revelation. Ah, yes, one of your Earth emotions. Laugh at us all you want, but we Star Trek fans, we're operating on a different level. My mother, who referred to the show as Star Drek, would snap off the TV and tell me to do my homework, that there was always a red alert, and if, as if daring me, said that no, there are no careers in watching Star Trek. She admitted defeat when I started writing the One Trek Mind column on StarTrek.com and began hosting panels at Star Trek conventions. And now I'm doing this podcast. And she just called to say that she was sorry about the passing of Dr. Spock. And I'll never quite know if that famous malapropism was intentional on her behalf. In 2007, I went to the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas with a videographer who had never seen an episode. He'd heard the title, but couldn't even name any of the captains. I got the clear sense that his ignorance was deliberate and proud. But when he saw a poster with Leonard Nimoy and his pointy ears, even he couldn't keep up the charade. Oh yeah, that's Spock. That's an icon. Indeed, Chaplin's tramp, Nimoy's ears. To argue which has a greater impact would be illogical. The stories of how Nimoy personally tweaked the character of Spock to perfection have been told numerous times. He felt slugging a villain was too boorish, so he suggested an alternative that became the Vulcan nerve pinch. That would be episode five of season one, The Enemy Within. But we all know that the best use was in season one, episode 23, A Taste of Armageddon. Vulcan salute, first seen when Spock is greeted by the High Priestess T'Pau in season two, episode one, Amok Time, was something Nimoy cribbed from seeing as a child in Orthodox synagogues. But beyond these factoids is the sense that Nimoy, through his association with the character, was a living representation of the utopia that Star Trek represented. Unlike his lovable comrade William Shatner goofing around on horseback, Nimoy appealed to the audience's more cerebral side. For post-Trek trash television, I'll take In Search Of over Rescue 911 any day. And Nimoy took this in stride. In his two autobiographies, he joked how scientists at NASA and JPL would want to show him their latest work, and he would nod and pretend that he knew what they were talking about, never wanting to disillusion them that he was just an actor. Famously, that first book was 1975's I Am Not Spock, the title misinterpreted as a diss to Star Trek fans. Really, it was a way to tell his story in comparison with that of his most famous character. This, of course, was followed up in 1995 with I Am Spock, giving us all the opportunity to say, aha, I knew it! When he died earlier this year, Nimoy was just shy of his 84th birthday. He overcame a battle with alcoholism. He had tremendous comic timing, especially since his character was supposed to show no emotion. He was a key player in the early fight against Holocaust deniers. I only met him once, for 30 seconds. I showed him my Vulcan salute, and he smiled warmly and gave me a compliment, as if every other idiot doesn't come up and do the same exact thing. How much does Nimoy mean to the hardcore Star Trek fan? Let's just say I own his albums, and sometimes, when it's just me in the quiet of night, I play them without even a plank length worth of irony. Listen to his ode to the heavens, You Are Not Alone, and tell me it isn't a beautiful melody. Let's also just say that I can't even think about the final scene between Nimoy and the new Spock, Zachary Quinto, at the close of J.J. Abrams' 2009 Star Trek without sobbing, especially today. Spock is dead, they say. Long live Spock. And that's from the 27th of February, 2015. So that's how I was feeling the day that he passed. And that's still how I'm feeling now. So listen, thanks for tuning in today. We hope you come back. We hope you subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. Subscribe, rate, and review us. Have you subscribed?
Affirmative.
Oh, she's subscribed. Have you subscribed?
Affirmative.
Have your friends subscribed?
Ah, we want to make sure your friends can say
affirmative
that they have subscribed. You want to go to play.it/StarTrek. You want to contact us, you can do it over Facebook at facebook.com/EngageTheOfficialStarTrekPodcast. You can also contact me via Twitter using the hashtag EngagePod. Hashtag EngagePod. And you can tweet at me at Jay Hoffman. Feel free to like and subscribe on me, if that means anything. And yeah, send us your comments. And we want to know what you think of the show so far. It's early days. We're season one. We're right at the beginning. So we want to know what you think. And we will talk to you again next time.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.